Good afternoon and welcome to Family First with five-time author and top speaker Randy Rolfe. Your family may be facing a variety of issues that you'd like addressed. No two families in the world face identical problems, but Randy has seen almost all of the difficulties families today face, and she and her expert guests have the answers that you seek. Now, here is your host, Randy Rolfe.
Hello and welcome to Family First. I'm your host, Randy Rolfe, and I'm very excited about today's show. Just want to mention that we have 45,000 listeners a month now with Family First, and I think it's because we bring you fabulous guests who know amazing things about how to make families thrive. And we have a worldwide audience, and I'm really grateful for all our listeners. And I encourage you, if you want to become a friend of Family First and help support the show now in its second year, you can go to www.indiegogo.com. That's IndieGogo.com, where you can get special thank you gifts for any level of contribution to Family First. But of course, the show is free, and I'm delighted to bring wonderful people to you every week. Today, we're going to be talking about what can the dying teach us about living. And it's an amazing topic. Don't be discouraged. We're all facing loved ones that are reaching that transition. As our population ages, an ever bigger proportion of our population is dealing with end-of-life issues. And what can we learn from the experience of those dying? What can they teach us about life as well as about death? And how can we help to make their transition more peaceful and love-filled? My guest this week on Family First is Becky Hawkins, author of the new book, Transitions, A Nurse's Education About Life and Death. Becky Hawkins is a natural storyteller and a great listener, and she brought those gifts with her as she sat by the bedside of seriously ill or terminally ill patients for more than 30 years as an oncology and hospice nurse. It's her compassion and warmth that encouraged so many of her charges to share their heartfelt thoughts and experiences with her. She's going to share with us today what she's learned from her experiences and also reveal a kind of blueprint for how to help our loved ones go through their end-of-life transition with peace, grace, and love. Becky became a nurse's aide at age 19, and she'll tell us more of her story, but she was inspired to earn her degree in nursing from that experience of being a nurse's aide. And then early on, she chose to work in the oncology unit in a large city hospital. She then progressed to outpatient oncology, hospice, and eventually became a hospice chaplain as well. Upon retirement in the 90s, she became a volunteer with hospice patients. She was also instrumental in the care of many family members, and we'll talk about that. She loved the opportunity to work with the patients and their families, but she didn't know how to face the reality of not being able to save every patient. So she learned to deal with that. After seeing the stress that it left upon her and hearing the stories, her husband suggested she begin journaling, and that became the beginning of her writing. She eventually was penning a column for a local newspaper and did many, many articles personalizing the stories that she heard from the patients. And her column was called Beyond Statistics, which became syndicated and led to the creation of her new book, Transitions, A Nurse's Education About Life and Death. And this is a wonderful book, just filled with stories. You're right in the room with the patients and with Becky, and very moving. I'm just getting goosebumps thinking about it. So let me start by introducing you, Becky. Welcome to Family First.
Thank you so much, Randy. I'm very happy to be here with you today.
Great. So why did you write the book?
Well, my husband convinced me last year that there were more people than just the audience reading my weekly column in the paper that would benefit from the stories of these patients. And he said, you know what? You're getting old. You better do this before you can't. So I said, okay. And I went to Sedona, Arizona, and went to a writer's retreat called Write Your Book in 5 Days, Tom Bird Method, and indeed did, sat with 30 other people, and from our hearts wrote our stories. And so I wrote my book in 5 days, came home, added a few stories to it, and got it done.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah, there's some wonderful programs like Tom Berg's about how to get that story out of yourself and
yes.
put it out for others.
Birthing that book.
Awesome. So, let me ask you just, most people wouldn't choose to work with seriously ill and dying patients. So didn't you get depressed taking care of those patients for so many years? How did you handle that?
I think with time, I began to understand that what I needed to do was something like journaling, to write and to express some of my emotions on paper, even if I didn't have it printed anywhere. I also learned I needed to find a balance and not only do that work, but also be involved with outdoor activities to make sure I got plenty of exercise, fresh air, and to be in a prayerful mode also during each day, and meditating, and you know, just spending some time doing fun things too.
That makes a lot of sense. So what wisdom did you come away with from your patients? What was the biggest impact?
I think the biggest impact, Randy, that the patients were able to help me understand was that we each need to accept this gift of life that we have, because it can be very brief. And my grandfather used to tell me that even if we live to be 110, it's brief because it goes by so fast. But to try to honor your footprints here and to live the day, each day, and understand that it is an honor to get to walk this space and place called life. And it's a huge opportunity to grow our soul and learning how to love one another and how to meet the challenges that each person meets every day. And that we can learn how to forgive ourselves and forgive others and understand that we're here with great purpose, on purpose, that we're beautiful, beloved beings, and we need to remember that it's not important what we collect as far as how many cars we have, how big our house is, or how much jewelry we have, how many degrees we have, or who we know, you know, that's famous. What's important, they said, was that we learned in these relationships that what we take with us is the love that we share with one another, as if it's woven into the DNA of our souls. One lady said that, Becky, she said, I went to the funeral home to make my arrangements. She said, I'm kind of like a control freak, and I wanted to make sure everything was in place ahead of time. And she said, what I found out is that there's no luggage racks on those caskets. She said, we're not taking anything with us except the love. And she said, at the end of the day, that's what matters, how we have treated one another.
Oh, that's beautiful. So that's what that experience taught you. I assume you had times when they hadn't picked up on that yet. They were still afraid, worried, living in the past, wishing they'd done something different.
Exactly.
So how did you help them make that transition to finding this kind of peace and realizing that the love they experienced was the most important thing?
Randy, I think one of the most important things that I learned over the years, and what I would hope everybody else can hear in this and hear in my patients' voices, is that we need to be present to these dear ones. We need to be able to listen to them. Sometimes we think we always have to have an answer for them or be able to respond to them with some great wisdom. But one of the most important things we can do is listen to them, be present to them, allow them to express fear, regret, or whatever, and not judge it. And the more time that I spent with a person, the more we were able to talk through, visit about, tell me what you are afraid of. Tell me what you're regretting the most. Tell me why. And then kind of just, you know, find that path weaving through that where we can discuss it. And a lot of times they come to the revelation on their own. you know what, I need to forgive that person. One guy said, you know, I've been mad at somebody for 40 years. He said, what am I doing? I'm dying. He said, I need to make peace with him. And he said that he couldn't even remember for sure what they were mad about. It had been so long. But he was hoping to, before he passed, to be able to call this guy and tell him that he was sorry, that he had not called him before. But he said, just as important as forgiving this fellow was forgiving himself and being able to say, you know, that's just what happened. Move forward. Today, you're letting go of that. So don't hang on to it anymore.
Oh, that makes so much sense. It's beautiful that they came to that realization themselves. If you were just there for them and asked them to tell you more. I've often said that with children. If you just sit there and listen and ask questions, they come up with their own answers.
Yes.
And so it's the same at end of life.
Yes. And you know, everybody's different. You know, some people struggle for quite a while with some of their regrets or some of their, you know, I wish I'd have done this or wish I'd have done that. And they, you know, they are helping us with those words because they're reminding us that the time with the children is precious. And one gentleman told me, he said, I'd give anything if I hadn't spent so much time working overtime to make more money. He said, I felt like I needed to buy them more stuff. And he said, you know, it's not about the stuff. They don't even remember what all I bought them. He said, what I regret is that I didn't go to more ball games with them, that I didn't use some of that money to take my wife on a vacation. He said, now look at me. I've spent all that money I worked so hard for on chemo and radiation and hospitalization and medication. He said, if I could go back, I would spend more time with my family and understand that that's really the greatest investment that a person can make is in each other. That's huge.
Yes, it is. I've heard the saying, you know, nobody on their deathbed wishes they'd spent more time at the office.
Right.
So can you share some more of your favorite stories, Becky?
Yes,
they're so wonderful.
One of my very favorite stories. In my book, I have several patients that have shared with me over the years near-death experiences that they had long before I ever met them. Or like in my brother's case, he had one just a few months before he passed. But this one gentleman, and pre-death visions, a lot of patients will tell you about family that's coming to escort them, angels that come to escort them. But one of my favorites was a precious little Pentecostal minister I was taking care of. And I was seeing him because of the damage that had been done to his heart and lungs from chemo and radiation years before, when all of this was new. He just was not faring well, respiratory-wise and cardiac-wise. But I was very happy to spend time with him because he was so willing to hear what I had to say and not afraid of dying, but wanted to make this as comfortable as he could for himself and his wife. But his wife was terrified, and there are stories in my book, but she would run off to the kitchen, and which was her safety net any time that I came. She just had a hard time hearing it. Mm-hmm. Well, not too long after I first started visiting him, I got a phone call at the office that his wife had called in, and she thought he was getting very close to dying, and could I hurry and get there? And I called her and said, Annie, I'm on my way. Go get the neighbor and let her be with you while you're waiting on me so you won't be so frightened, and try to remember everything that I've shared with you. When I arrived, the neighbor ran home, and she went back to the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And her precious husband was sitting there in his recliner, and he was very blue. He could not breathe well at all. And he said, Becky, can you get me in my bed? And I said, yes. And I picked that precious little fella up, and I carried him, and I situated him in the middle of his bed, and I held him straight up where he could breathe better. And I straddled behind him. I got behind him, and I had each one of my hands on his shoulders to hold him up. And all of a sudden, he tapped me on my fingertips, and he said, Becky, do you see them? And I said, no. Tell me what you're seeing. because I'd had other patients tell me that they, you know, had visitors.
Yes.
He said, "Sweetheart, the room is now full of angels." He said, "I have to go." And he hollered out to Annie, and he said, "Annie, I love you. I have to go. I'll see you again," with the little bit of breath that he had. And he raised up his right arm, and he said, "Oh, my Lord and my God." And he fell back against me, and he was gone. I just sat there for a little bit because I was beyond humbled, beyond grateful for that gift of being able to be there when that veil was parted and he transitioned. Many times, Randy, people have asked me, "Why do you do what you do? Why do you want to be in such a depressing job?" And my answer to them is, I wouldn't be anywhere else. This, to me, is just one of the best blessings on the face of the earth, to be involved in the transitioning process where you get to be a part of that. That's huge, because it's a constant reminder to me, and I'm a stubborn learner, but it's a good reminder to me each time that this is a precious, precious gift we have, and then we leave. I can't be more thankful for this. I tell people I feel somewhat like a midwife because I'm there being at this birthing process, this transitioning process into the next life. I'm not pushing, I'm not shoving, I'm not forcing, but I am present to that transition.
That's quite a story. Yes, to be in a room full of angels, that's a very special privileged experience to have had.
Yes.
Amazing. So those kinds of experiences have to be very inspiring and give you a lot of faith in the whole process.
Yes. It changed my spirituality completely. These people, this one lady, she was a little rough around the edges. I was taking care of her in a hospital. And she just told me. She said, "You know, I've had a lot of whiskey and a lot of cigarettes." She said, "And, you know, I'm paying the price here." And she had a deep, gravelly voice. And she said, "Becky, I've got these people that are coming here and they're visiting. And my sister's sitting over there in the corner, and she's been dead for years. And she just she told me she was going to help me cross over." She said, "What do you think about that?" I said, "Well, I think that's wonderful that she's come to assist you. I think it's great." She said, "Well, I told her she needed to cool her jets. I've got some more stuff I need to do first." I said, "Well, okay." I said, "I bet she'll wait on you." And I just was thrilled that she was, you know, brave enough to even share that with me. And, you know, the way that she was looking at the corner of the room, I couldn't help but think, you know, what a special sister you have. And the next morning, I hurried up the stairs to get to her room to see her, and she had passed.
My goodness. Wow. Well, Becky, we're already coming up on our first break. We're speaking with Becky Hawkins, author of Transitions, a Nurse's Education about Life and Death, and fascinating stories, very inspirational. So please come back after the break.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's R-A-N-D-Y-R-O-L-F-E.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back to Family First. I'm your host, Randy Rolfe, and we're speaking with Becky Hawkins, who's the author of Transitions, A Nurse's Education About Life and Death. Becky actually worked with oncology and hospice patients for over 30 years and wrote a column about the beyond statistics, the individuals that she was serving, and the great wisdom and inspiration and often humorous situations that they shared with her. And we've been hearing some of the stories and very inspiring situations. And we just spoke about one of her experiences with a gentleman who, several people actually, who felt that they had angels in the room before their passing. And I was remembering when my mother passed, my sister and I were in the room. Well, she passed after we had left. I think that's what she wanted to do. But the last day or two, she was very, very quiet. And now I'm thinking she may have been already feeling the presence of other people. She wasn't terribly religious, but she was very spiritual, and I think she would have been open to that kind of perception. And so that's really lovely. Does that make sense, Becky?
Yes, it does. And that's you brought up a good point because not everybody believes exactly the same. But we have had stories from people from all faiths, even people that didn't have any faith. You know, so that blessed me and educated me in even more ways. And I don't judge anyone where they are. And that's what I took with me as a chaplain when I became a chaplain later, is that I just respected totally wherever a person was. And I think people need to have that acceptance and the blessing of you not judging what they believe as you're with them at the bedside, because they're more apt to share with you when they know that you accept them just as they are.
Yes, personally, I think that's the essence of love, is to just connect with the good in a person and not judge them in any way. They are who they are, where they are, and there's a spirit there always.
Yes, yes. We're all on our own journeys, and we're one human family, and that's what I learned from them as well. One human family, and we all are connected, and we are precious, and we need to understand that that beautiful, beautiful God spark is in everybody. Now, some of us, you know, I've certainly been ornery in my days, have hide it sometimes.
Can be well hidden, yes.
But it's there.
Becky, can we talk about the fears that people have? And did you, before you started this kind of work, fear death, and has that changed? Can we talk about that?
Yes, Randy, that is a common thing that people do ask me, are people afraid? And yes, some of them are. I think our neck of the woods, our place in the world, there is a lot of fear of death. Because some people have been told as children that if they didn't believe a certain way, if they didn't behave a certain way, that they were not going to make it, and that they were going to go to a horrible place. Also, there are people that fear suffering. You know, are you going to be able to take care of any pain that I have or any suffering that I have. There are people that are afraid of leaving their loved ones, that they may never see them again because they're not sure about what's on the other side. So a good hospice team, I think, Randy, can go in and bring to them a lot of what they need, certainly a good medication to help them with their pain, reassure them that they will continue to work with that, or if they're having trouble breathing, to work with those aspects as well, you know, to make them comfortable physically as much as possible, and then to also have a chaplain that can visit with them and hear them, hear their fears, not preach at them, but hear them and then pray with them and listen to them to try to help them understand that there isn't a horrible judging that's going on the other side. That's what these people have been able to share with us that have had these near-death experiences, that there's so much unconditional love to such a degree that they can barely figure out a word that would describe it. So I think that's important, too, to get across to people. I'm hoping with my book that people can hear my patients' voices enough and their stories enough to understand that we should not fear death, that we need to be able to be very strong and brave and living our own authentic lives, and very strong and brave and knowing that we don't have to fear dying. And yes, it did make a difference in my aspect, too. I've never thought about being afraid of dying, but as I took care of more and more patients that were, I became even more solid in my belief that I am not. I am not afraid to die. Now, I'm not running toward it. You know, I'm glad to be here. And I think we should be and understand and respect that this blessing of being here is a true, true gift. And that we're here with great purpose. But I also believe that it's good to have a healthy understanding of the process and not be afraid to approach it ahead of time. Because, you know, all of us, Randy, all of us, are either going to be standing at the bedside of a loved one, or we already have, or we're in the process of it right now, and then someday it's going to be us. So it's good to not dwell on it, but to have a healthy idea of the whole process.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And as I said at the beginning, you know, more and more of us, you know, our population is aging. So even more people are dealing with end of the life issues. And if you're afraid of it, you might run from preparing or thinking about it or talking about it or listening about it. Mm-hmm. And it's important to accept that this is part of life, and each person needs to be open to doing what is necessary to prepare. It makes a lot of sense. I wanted to ask you about a couple of the stories in the book. One that stands out is the story of Bertha, where she just said she didn't want to be fed anymore. She was done with this life. Can you tell how that experience was dealing with her?
She was...
That was chapter 16, I think.
Yes, she was one that was getting a tube feeding. And she was trying to help them understand that she did not want that anymore. She wanted them to stop force feeding her. And she would call me into the room and say to me, "Can you make my family understand that I'm done? I don't want any more part of this." And because they had called me there three different times, the doctor would call me and say, "Becky, you've got to go back. She's pulled her feeding tube out again." Mm. And so finally, when she had this conversation with me, instead of just looking at me, because she dreaded that, she hated that, and her daughter would hold her hands, you know, and say, "Okay, Mother, we've got to get this down." So when she visited with me about that, and she said, "You know, I'm not going to get any better. You're feeding the tumor. You're not feeding me. Let me stop this." And then her daughter said, "Oh, my gosh." She said, "This is my fault." She said, "Because I wanted her to stay here, and I was forcing her. I kept thinking, if I keep feeding her, she's going to live longer." And she said, it's not about me. It's about her. And so she was able to say, yes, I'm ready. I'm ready for you to leave that out, and we'll go from here. Because this sweet little woman kept saying, you know, I'm not going to do it. You're not going to make me. I'm not going to make it happen. No, I'm not going to do it. And she helped them to understand. She wanted to just go and not be force-fed anymore. And I think that makes a lot of sense because people fight with that fear. Families fight with that. What am I going to do? Mother's going to starve to death. Talk to your doctor. Talk to your hospice group. Talk to your family member and get a good understanding of where everybody is on that. And so that you can understand, no, you're not starving your mother. You're not killing your mother. The cancer is, or whatever else. And so, you know, we just need to, we as a nation and we as the world need to get a better grip on that. Let's have our right to do whatever we want to do as far as our death is concerned. We need to listen to people when they say to us, yeah, if I'm terminal, then let's stop this stuff that you think you need to keep doing to me. How many kidneys do you think you're going to give me to keep me here? We just need to revisit the whole thing. I hope we will start moving in that direction where we can have an open discussion and listen to these patients and what they're saying to us.
Yes, I think that may happen. The baby boom generation is now watching their parents go through this, and the baby boom generation usually talks loud about the issues they're going through. And I think it's so important for families to realize and that it is about the person who's going through the transition rather than them holding on. And I know with my mother and with the women I interviewed for my book, Mothers Losing Mothers, it was a moment of peace when they realized it's really about her. What does she want? Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful story about the daughter realizing, you know, she wasn't going to starve her mom. Her mom wanted to move on. So
yes, and to give them permission, because a lot of times, Randy, there are people that will stand at the bedside and say, please, mother, don't leave me, don't leave me, don't leave me. And that poor mother, torn because she's so ready to go. And so we try to help them understand that the most loving thing that you can do at that point is to give them permission to go. Say, I love you. I thank you for all that you've done for me, all that you've given me. I will carry on with me always. And I will see you again, and I will stay with you. I will sit with you until I have walked with you as far as I can on this side of your transition. I give you permission to go.
Yeah, I think that is so important. I know, I think my mother relaxed when we said, we'll take care of each other. We're going to be fine. You've given us all you need to give.
Yes.
And we
That's
honor.
It's beautiful that you all were able to do that. And you're right, Randy. A lot of them, I've seen a lot of them, wait till a loved one goes out to get a drink of water. Wait till a loved one goes out to pick up the mail. And they will go.
Right.
It's almost like they're trying to save them from the passing experience. And then, you know, it's not everyone is alike on all of that, but I've seen that happen several times.
Yes, yes. They kind of wait for you to go because they don't. She'd been scared when her dad was passing, and my sister realized that, we described this in the book, that she maybe didn't want us to go through that. So
exactly.
So I wanted to ask you about another story. A couple that were celebrating their 75th wedding anniversary. That's such a beautiful idea.
Yes, very, very, very precious. I was in a nursing home as a nurse's aide. As you mentioned earlier, and working with these patients And it was the hardest work I'd ever done, the least amount of pay I'd ever been paid, and yet I loved it. And for me to get to take care of somebody, you know, that was that age, you know, they were in their late 90s or 100 and 102 or something like that, but still able to communicate, set up in their rockers, cute as could be. They were just adorable. Had a hard time hearing, of course, but were able to talk. And they were celebrating their 75th wedding anniversary. And if it's okay, I'll just share that with them.
Yes, please.
I had the honor of officiating in a wedding one summer. The darling couple looked like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie in that starstruck stage when they looked at each other. And at the time, my husband and I were celebrating 40 years of marriage, and he said he didn't remember that starstruck stage. But I helped care for Annie and Bill in 1971. They had outlived all four of their children, and they were frail but mentally strong, and they tolerated my questions. They were celebrating their 75th wedding anniversary. I had never met anyone who attained such a status. They sat in side-by-side homemade oak rockers. She was a stout woman with her hair combed back tightly into a low-sitting bun roll that was silver grayish in color. Her dress looked right out of the 40s, and so did her black lace-up shoes. Her stockings were rolled up above her knees and tied with a piece of fabric. I'd seen that before on my grandmother, so that didn't shock me. He was very thin with wired-rimmed glasses hanging off the end of his long, pointed nose, was nearly totally deaf, and had thinning white hair cut really short above the ears and way up the nape of his neck. He had on bib overalls and a short-sleeved cotton plaid shirt with a hanky stuffed in the front bib pocket. Both of them were just too cute for words, looking like a Norman Rockwell calendar picture. "So which one of you deserves the biggest crown in this marriage?" I asked them. They looked at each other and grinned and then pointed at each other with, "He does, she does." "Mother, you talk to her. My teeth are loose and I'm clacking too much," she said. "All right, come sit here close to me on this little footstool and let me tell you what everybody always asks us. How do you stay married that long?" You have to understand that when me and Father got married, there wasn't any question of not staying married. His dad gave us a section of land to get us started with, a little old four-room house and an outhouse, a sagging, faded barn, a milk cow, a mule, and a swayed-back horse, a sow, and a few chickens. There was work to do to survive. We were a team. It was hard times. And there wasn't much time for fussing because we were so gall-darn tired at the end of the day. I think we were just glad that we made it another day. We were blessed, both of us, with parents who were godly and gave us good examples on how to raise a family. We weren't so serious every moment, though. We did raise four kids. You know, life's uncertain, and I think we are both trying to figure out why we're still here, and all of our kids are gone now. We leave it with God. We think we must still be here for a reason. Maybe it's to tell you young folk our story, who knows. "Father, what do you want to tell her?" she hollered over in his good ear. "Don't go to bed mad, and don't spend money you don't have. Find something to laugh at every now and then, and go to a barn dance and dance with your wife like she's the best-looking woman there. And remember, if one of you needs to be in the barn tinkering with something longer than usual, or if the other one of you needs to be fussing alone in the kitchen way after supper dishes are done, let him alone," he hollered back, and then he slumped back into his padded rocker with his eyes closed. That wore him out. "Oh, yes, it does a couple good if you pray for each other. We still do that," she added. "And remember, a vow is a vow." And that was it. They both fell asleep. They were exhausted from our chat. Lucky me.
Oh, that's such a wonderful story.
I never met anyone since who'd been married that long. Oh, goodness. Makes me tear up a little.
Yes, yes, it's so beautiful. Yes, my husband and I, we have a goal of being married 100 years.
Yay!
His parents were married 67 years, I think it is. But 75 is fabulous. Just such an inspiration.
It is.
Absolutely. We're talking with Becky Hawkins, who's the author of Transitions, A Nurse's Education About Life and Death. And it's really a series of wonderful vignettes with people in serious condition, either terminally ill or dealing with a serious illness in oncology or hospice. And your writing is just delightful, and you can just see these people. So their names have been changed to protect their families' privacy, but the stories are so real, and I really appreciate it. So listeners, stay tuned. We have one more segment with Becky Hawkins.
Learn more. Live better. Voice America Health and Wellness.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RandyRolfe.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back to Family First. We're speaking with Becky Hawkins, who's the author of Transitions, a Nurse's Education About Life and Death, which are stories taken from her 30 years of experience working in the oncology unit of a large city hospital, in outpatient oncology, in hospice, and eventually became a hospice chaplain because she was so moved by working with the seriously ill and the terminally ill. She's been sharing some wonderful stories that are in her book, and I wanted to ask about one of the stories that really, they're all so moving, but one that really grabbed me was Mr. Brown, the brave soldier, and because that kind of brings up the issue of what you see with your eyes, it ends up being quite different from what you experience from a person. So can you tell about that story?
Yes, I would love to share that story with you. He was one of my favorite patients. He didn't really fit on his bed, even though we had gotten him the extra long one before he was admitted to our ward. And the supervisor warned me. She said, "Now listen, don't take anything he says too personally. He's an old veteran, and he curses and he swears and he likes young nurses." And I thought, "Oh boy, here we go." Mm-hmm. Well, the doctor, you have to understand, this was back in the early 80s. He allowed him to smoke a cigar with supervision for about 5 minutes every day because he said, okay, he's dying. He can have his cigar. He basically just chews on it anyway. So, let him do it. Just make sure the oxygen's turned off. Well, I went to make my introduction and do my assessment of him, and he whistled and he roared and in a big old gruff voice, and he said, "Well, hello, sunshine. Where have you been all my life?" And I thought, oh. But normally I would have been entertained, but I couldn't help but notice that the blood on his sheet was, he just had so much oozing from his body all over him that it kind of took me back for a few minutes. I excused myself, and I went to the dressing cart, and I got all the stuff to wrap his wounds. His skin was real thin, and it was black and blue and purple, and I had never seen anything quite like it. I was still kind of new to all this. And so I got back in the room, and he said, just wrap me up some more cupcake. I'll be fine, and when you get through seeing your other patients, come back in here, and we'll share that stogie in my bedside table drawer. The doctor gave me permission, so don't get all holy and tell me I can't have it. Besides, I want to look at you some more and tell you some more stories. And then he roared and laughed and smiled from ear to ear, and he goes, what do you got to say about that? Well, and then he went on, and he said, I even bet we could get a snort of whiskey, or how about some scotch? Yeah, that's what it is. That's what we need. Call up that nutrition lady who always wants me to be drinking more fluids and tell her I want some smoky scotch. Well, that'll get her. And I lost it, and I couldn't help but smile. And I was pointing my finger at him, and I said, no scotch tonight. We'll fix you up with your little cigar, because the doctor said you could, but no scotch. He didn't say anything about scotch. And I tried to control my voice when I was backing out the door. But I was grinning ear to ear, too. And he said, wait a minute, leave that door open a crack. I'm not wanting to be by myself in here without being able to see and escape in case I need it. I wasn't able to leave him alone very much because of all the bleeding. I had to redress the dressings frequently and give him 2 units of packed red blood cells. And that evening, his doctor pulled me aside and he said, you know, those blood transfusions really aren't helping him all that much. He said, we're going to have to stop all this. So he went in to talk to him, and that precious man said, sure, Doc, you know your stuff. We know how it is. You've done all you can. You're a good soldier, Doctor, and I'm ready to meet this enemy head on. Well, some of the employees thought the doctor was out of line giving him that cigar, and I even heard that someone snuck in a little scotch one evening. These days, it probably would never happen. Maybe it would. I was just tickled that somebody was brave enough to do that and that I had got to spend some time with him. He taught me a lot.
For sure. Yeah, you can't judge a book by its cover, and it's best just not even to judge. That's
right,
a great,
ever.
Great story.
Yes.
So,
surprise you.
Yes. And we have so many veterans that are coming back with wounds and really hurting mentally and physically. And I hope there are people like you there for them. So how was it different for you, Becky, when you were caring for a family member that you'd known all your life, presumably?
It's a challenge, and they really say that you need to try to lay down your robe of nursing just have your cloak of being a family member. You know, we just be the sister. Well, that was really tough for me, especially the last chapter in the book is called My Brother's Keeper, and it's about the journey I had with my brother 3 years ago. He was dying with lung cancer. And for me, it was a huge honor to take care of him and be with him. He was the youngest of us 4 siblings, and I'm the oldest, and we had always been very close. So I was very protective of him. I was with him from the day of diagnosis through all of his chemo, his radiation, his dying process, and I even did his service. But the gift that he gave to all of us through all of that was that a few months before he passed, he was feeling rough. Before we had actually got to start seeing the radiation doctor and the oncologist, and I said, do you want to go to the ER? And he said, no, I'm going to stay right here in my recliner. And I said, okay, call me if you get to feeling worse. Well, he called me, only he couldn't talk. He was gasping. And I said, okay, I'm calling an ambulance. I'm on my way. I'll be right there. And then I called my dad because he was living with our dad, and I said, Daddy, go get Jeffrey up and shake him. He may have some kind of obstruction in his chest. I don't know what's going on. Just try to get him to breathe. I said, I've got an ambulance on the way, and I'm on my way. When I got there, the ambulance was there. They had my brother setting up, and he was blue. He was barely breathing, but he was breathing. got him to the hospital, spent 10 days there, and at that point, we got the radiation started, the chemotherapy started, and got him back home. And, of course, we had to continue going every day for the radiation treatment. And one of those days that we were on the road to head to the big city hospital, he tapped me on the shoulder while I was driving, and he said, "Say, I about died there at the house that night." And I said, "Well, no kidding." I said, "You were purple when I got there." I said, you really were about gone." He said, "No, you're not listening to me. I about died." And I turned to him because I knew then what he was trying to tell me. And I said, "What did you see?" And he said, "Our mother, who died in 2002, was on one side of him, and a good friend of his who had committed suicide the year before was on the other side of him. That he'd been coughing and choking and coughing and choking, and suddenly he was out of his body and in this beautiful, white, light space full of love. And there comes my mother and his best friend." And he said he looked at them because he understood what was taking place. And he said, "Please, please, I just need a little bit more time." And our mother turned to him and said, "Then breathe, son, breathe." And all of a sudden, he was back, and he was with the ambulance workers. For us, that was huge, because my brother was afraid of dying, and he was afraid of what was next. And he was reassured from that. But even more so was that friend that had committed suicide, because we had been told as children, if you did that, you went to hell. Well, I don't believe in hell anymore, for one thing. But for another thing, to know that this person who had struggled so much with that decision and then made it was well and fine and full of love gave him such a new lease on the rest of the life that he had and helped him so much to understand that it wasn't as we had been told, that there is more love than we can ever imagine just on the other side of that transition.
Oh, what a moving story. And to have been there and for him to have asked for a little more time from the people he loved who were gone. My goodness.
Yes.
And the comment on suicide, yes, that's really precious.
Yes.
And gave him such reassurance. That's really wonderful. So let's see, we're... I have so many more questions, but what would you say to our listeners about how to ease transitions of the people they love now prospectively? You know, if they have an aging mom or a sick sister or something like that.
I think, Randy, the most important thing I learned from my patients was that they want somebody just to be with them. You don't have to talk all the time. The power of our presence to one another is huge. And I witnessed that time and time again, sibling with sibling, children with parents, parents with children, spouse with spouse, friends with friends. And that moment of that time where you are there, what you're saying with your presence is more than you can speak. Because it means that you're saying to them, "I am here for you. And your life matters. And your blessing of our relationship to me brings me here. And I will be with you. I will stand with you. I will be with you as much as I can be, as much as I'm allowed to be." It gives that person a sense of that they do not have to be as frightened because they know that someone that cares about them and does not judge them, loves them unconditionally, has come to be with them. It means everything whenever we recognize one another and are brave enough, because it's hard for some people, but brave enough, even if you go for just a few minutes, you know, maybe you can share an old story, an old memory, or if you're a sibling, you know, talk about some of the fun things that happened. do you remember the day that we went to the creek, you know, and that frog jumped on your back? Or as a child, and you say to your mother, Mom, I'll never forget the way that you always made my birthday special. We didn't have much, but you made that cake that I always wanted. And then you made me something from scratch out of a little bit of material that you had to make me know that I was special in your eyes. It matters that we care for each other. And that's one of the main things, Randy, that they taught me.
That's so powerful.
It's how we treat each other.
Yes, isn't that true? And such wonderful stories to illustrate it. So do you plan on writing another book, Becky?
Yes, I have so many stories. I am writing the second book because there's so much here in my office of all the times that I was journaling from so many people.
Oh, that's really neat. So how can people find your book, Transitions in Nurses' Education About Life and Death?
You can find my book, paperback, or the digital version on my website, Lady Hawk Publishing, LadyHawk Publishing.com. And it is on Amazon.com, and it's on BarnesandNoble.com.
Great, great. And I understand that you are sharing your stories in person, too. You have a speaking program?
Yes. I've spoken at hospitals and to nursing students and civic groups. I'm getting ready to go to Sedona, Arizona next month. I'm speaking to a near-death experience lecture class, having a book signing there. I'm thrilled to do that. I'm going to Santa Fe, New Mexico to speak to a group. So I'm just really, really blessed that people are saying, please come share your stories with us because we want to hear, but we want to know why we do not need to fear death.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on Family First. I really appreciate it. And please spread the word about we're spiritual beings and it's how we care about each other that matters. So thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you, Randy, and bless you, darling, and all that you're doing because you're leaving beautiful footprints here.
Oh, thank you so much. Goodbye now.
Bye, honey.
We hope you've enjoyed Family First. Please tune in to our program every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time, to join your host, Randy Rolfe, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. The weekend is here. Enjoy it with your family. And we hope to see you here next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.